I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell. As you'll remember from the last record, we're on to the second part of the railway killers.
Yes, welcome back. It's a grim and slightly eerie story, but it is one that always sticks in my memory. If you've listened to the first part, you'll know that by the end of that, John Duffy, the shorter of the two men, has been convicted of 5 rapes and 2 murders.
Yeah.
His accomplice, his partner in crime, David Mulcahy, is threatening to sue the Metropolitan Police for wrongful arrest because he didn't have anything to do with it, and Duffy's gone to jail.
All right. Well, we're just going to jump back in, guys. So this is part two of the railway killers.
Duffy maintains a studious silence throughout his first 8 years in prison. Mulcahy lives a perfectly ordinary life.
Do you think when they were discussing this kind of thing at any point, they had a conversation that was like, if one of us goes down, we'll never dob in the other one kind of thing?
I think Duffy was genuinely terrified of Mulcahy. I think he thought that Mulcahy would probably kill him if he said anything, even if he was in jail. And it took a very, very long time for Duffy to change his mind. And indeed, it wasn't until August 1996, 8.5 years after Duffy had been sent down, he was given a minimum of 30 years, whole life, a life term with a minimum of 30 years, which was raised to a whole life term by the then Home Secretary, Douglas Hurd. That was in the time when Home Secretaries could intervene in cases, which they no longer can. Mulcahy resumed an ordinary life with his wife and children.
But now he's got no partner, he's not doing any crime.
Well, he's not as active. I think he committed other crimes in this period, but he's not as active as he was when he was with Duffy. I think one of the other things that always strike me about this is that many people who knew the Mulcahys and, you know, the Mulcahy family said they were a very happy couple and he seemed perfectly normal to them. Nevertheless, in August 1996, a 66-year-old woman is raped.
It's a bit of a change of MO.
It is. A 66-year-old woman is raped on Hampstead Heath. Now, thanks to one or two quick-witted Metropolitan Police officers, they begin to look at the similarity between that attack and the attacks that Duffy has already been charged with, because they've always believed that Duffy had an accomplice. They just didn't know who or couldn't prove who that accomplice was. One or two things, an evidence locker. There was a piece of sellotape that had been used on one of the victims, which, believe it or not, actually had Mulcahy's fingerprint on it, but it had never been fingerprint tested at the time. A whole series of tiny details began to emerge, thanks to good old fashioned police work.
Yeah, great. So they could go back.
Over the old.
Yeah.
But even more significantly, Duffy by now has begun to suffer considerable remorse, and he starts to confess to a prison psychiatrist. And if you put the two parts together, Duffy's confession and this extra good old-fashioned police work.
Was it remorse rather than him just being like, that's not fair that I've been in prison for 8 years and
no,
my buddy hasn't?
Duffy, remember, the Catholic of the two.
Oh, yeah, Catholic guilt.
Said, and I think it's one of those extraordinary things, when it got to the trial, Duffy said, and I quote, "I feel a lot of guilt. I have raped and killed young ladies. I accept that. I'm not trying to shift the blame. I did what I did." He went on, "I've been in custody for many years and I've had a hard time coming to terms with what I'm in for, rapes and murders. I feel a lot of guilt for what I've done and want to make a clean slate." He wanted, as he put it, get things off his chest. Mm. Finally, after the confession, after the extra police work, in February 1999, Mulcahy is arrested and charged with 7 rapes, 5 plotting to rape and 3 murders. It is pretty much, since Duffy was arrested, 13 years.
Wow.
The CPS build the case against Mulcahy, and his trial begins at the Central Criminal Court at Old Bailey in October 2000. The principal witness is, of course, John Duffy.
Oh, yeah, of course. That's quite weird, isn't it?
The principal witness.
So he sat in court with him every day.
Well, across the court.
Telling the jury what they did.
Yes, yes. But Mulcahy...
But he gets cross-examined.
Of course. But Mulcahy also pleads innocent to a number of the rapes, forcing his victims to relive the crime.
So bad.
In court.
Have they changed the rules about rape victims in court since then?
No. Pretty much the same.
Same.
Mulcahy also claimed that Duffy had been paid £20,000 to confess, to fit him up.
By who?
Ah, good question.
What purpose? Or where's the money going to go so he can buy a new toothbrush?
It went into a building society account, so Mulcahy... no fewer than 6 rape victims were forced to give evidence. And the jury of 6 men and 6 women took a long time to convict Mulcahy.
God, I would have thought they would have done it really quickly.
Well, it was a long trial. It started in October and didn't finish until February.
It's long.
It's a long trial. And Mulcahy put up a stern defence. Eventually, however, they convict him. The most senior judge at the Central Criminal Court is called the Recorder of London. In February 2001, Judge Michael Higham told Mulcahy that the killings were acts of desolating wickedness in which you descended to the depths of depravity in carrying them out. He then added, "These were sadistic killings, and out of the two of you, I have no doubt it was you who derived gratification from the act of killing." He sentenced Mulcahy to 3 life terms for the murders, 24 years for 7 rapes and 5 planned rapes. He also recommended he should serve a minimum of 30 years before even being considered for release.
How old was he by then, though?
Well, he was born in 1959, so just over 40. Now, Mulcahy, interestingly, is not subject to a whole life term.
Why not?
Because he wasn't given one.
Just a judging decision.
Well, no, the judging decision in the Duffy case was he should get a minimum of life with a minimum of 30 years, which the Home Secretary then upgraded to a whole life term. In Mulcahy's case, his sentence was never upgraded. So the irony is that Mulcahy could theoretically get out of prison in his early 70s in 2031, whereas Duffy
will never get out of jail.
Now, there is a caveat, and an important caveat to that. Mulcahy continues to this day to protest his innocence.
Why? I don't know what's wrong with people.
His family stood by him. They believe that he was set up, fitted up by Duffy. Mulcahy also encouraged his followers and friends to set up a website, just as Jeremy Bamber has done, pleading his innocence. And it's a very sophisticated website in which he says, "This nightmare is not a story of a famous writer. It's the true story of a man or our friend who is still incarcerated, who is still praying and who still believes that sometime soon a retrial will prove his innocence." There are then a long series of attacks on Duffy. He says that Duffy was particularly angry because Mulcahy gave a statement about the beating up of his wife.
Safe to say they're not friends anymore.
Yeah, the site concludes, "No smoke without fire. Good saying, and I used to use it a lot before, but I know smoke can do and can be used as a smoke screen. I don't expect to be believed on face value. All that I ask is that you look at the evidence and come to your own conclusions. You could be the person who writes a massive wrong." In my view, Mulcahy's protestations of innocence are going to be exactly the same and have exactly the same effect as Jeremy Bamber's, who's now been protesting his innocence for more than 30 years, and indeed wrote me a long letter, which I include in my book, Pure Evil. It is very difficult to be released from prison, even after your minimum term, until you have admitted responsibility for the crime for which you were convicted. It is therefore, ironically, or perhaps you might say, reasonable that Mulcahy, if he persists in this along this line, will in fact also end his life behind bars, as did Duffy. But they are a fascinating combination. They are, well, one person, I think it was Court News, that's right, Court News UK, a website.
What's Court News?
Basically a website. Called them the Thriller Killers. And the prosecutor is quoted as saying, "Mulcahy was getting more out of this. He wanted something more than just rape. He was the taller who enjoyed exercising power. He was an arrogant and cruel character, playing with his victims as if the whole thing was a game, getting satisfaction and enjoyment from bullying and picking on the vulnerable." Mulcahy later told his accomplice he'd killed Alison Day because she might recognise them. But as I've said, Duffy said David actually enjoyed it. Mulcahy was also described as a monster without feeling. I have to say I rather agree with that description. And the police said after the conviction of Mulcahy that they believed that he committed other offences on his own and with Duffy. One unnamed victim spoke later of her anguish. She criticised the response of the officers initially and said the procedures had improved. But what it underlines is that rape can all too often be a prelude to murder. There are countless examples in American serial killers and in European ones. It's a very thin line between rape and murder.
Well, that thing you said about the power and feeling like God or being having control over someone's life obviously is very significant.
But when you may remember that the last one we did, Stephen Port, the grinder killer, that was violence against gay men. And there are a number of examples of that. Stephen Greaveson, for example, the so-called Colhern killer, rather. But that's sex as a prelude.
That was a different kind of thing, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but sex as a prelude.
Also, they didn't drug their victims. Because there's something kind of cowardly about Stephen Port and his, like, making someone so unconscious they don't know what's going on, not cowardly. And do you know what I mean? There's something a bit kind of different. Because that's not like, oh, I can exert power over you and I can that sort of...
But there have been a number of date rape cases and serial date rape cases.
Oh, yeah.
Against women. What I'm saying is I think that... And that's why I'm interested to talk to you about it. This is a particularly nasty example of serial rape leading to serial murder.
Yeah.
And I think it must or should send a shudder down the spine of any young woman or indeed older woman to be very aware, to be very wary.
Yeah, definitely. Although, I mean, if it's, you know, if you're a 15-year-old girl riding her bike in the park, you know, all it does is just, like, make parents more afraid to let their children do anything without supervision and, you know, make us women more afraid to do anything without being cautious. But it's good to be cautious.
I think it's absolutely essential. And if these podcasts have any kind of moral, it is that horror lurks in the most ordinary places. And this, this time, railway stations.
But sometimes that kind of, like, you know, senseless violence, it's just, there's just nothing you can do if you're just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Not when there's a spate in this instance where it's a serial rapists, and at that time no one was really doing anything to stop them, so they were just on a rampage. So I think that's a bit different. But when's that one of those stories about sort of like some poor chap leaving the tube station and getting his phone out and then being mugged for his phone and killed, you know, that, like, that kind of senseless violence is a bit, is, do you know what I mean? So there's only so much you can do, but you should always be careful.
Yes, I mean, and this is quite separate from the whole concept of gang warfare and
knife
crime and gun crime in London or Nottingham or anywhere else.
Totally.
This is completely different. This is domestic.
Yeah, also it's targeted and it's like premeditated. And although gang violence is often premeditated, its background is not, the maliciousness is not two people deriving some kind of pleasure out of it. It's all about the gang stuff's completely different. And also there are lots of times it's just kids that don't really know what they're doing or that understand the consequences of what they're doing, whereas I feel like these two definitely could understand what the consequences of what they were doing would be.
Yes, it reminded me of the evidence of Duffy's ex-wife, Margaret, who said that... she told the Old Bailey at Duffy's trial that he would rape her during bondage sessions and would terrorise their German shepherd dog, Toby.
I'm really offended by the... Obviously, all of it's really bad, but why would you take your dog with you when you went and raped someone? It's, like, really horrible.
Yes, I mean... Duffy's wife, as I was referring to earlier, told the court that he would regularly go out for long periods with his friend Mulcahy, always carrying a knife, and he would regularly force her to have sex. Now, I think that it's worth pointing out that if the harming of pets or animals is one characteristic, I think threats to partners or wives is another characteristic of someone who is capable, at least, of considering rape. And I'm not, it's obviously not a blanket, but it is certainly an issue in that. Because sometimes everybody has their own methods, but this is genuinely terrifying. You know, if weapons are being used or if you're being threatened with scissors or a knife or whatever... And I think it's that looking for the, as I say, that moral that we'd be talking about. Looking for the, what comes out of what of these terrible crimes.
Yeah.
It's finding something to give an indication of what is possible, what could happen.
Well, yes, just to be very conscious and aware of any of those things going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. Well, I hope everyone is cautious, but, you know, don't live your life in fear, because that's...
No, you can't, and you mustn't. And good things happen to good people just the same as...
Bad things.
Bad things.
I am definitely cautious and sensible, but sometimes I find, like, being too much can send you a bit OCD.
Yeah.
Not send you a bit OCD, but you know what I mean.
But we live in...
Can be kind of exhausting. But I'm thinking more about, like, should I leave the windows open? Or, like, have I left the gas on, when you probably haven't left the gas on?
No. And there are... You know, if you spend your entire life thinking only that you could run into Mulcahy and Duffy, well, we're not going to see very many of that kind.
Not of that kind. Not as bad as that. You're more likely just to be caught in the crossfire of that kind of senseless violence that we talked about just now.
You know, I don't think either of us, and I certainly wouldn't want to, suggest for a second that this is something that's going to happen every week or every month or indeed every year. It isn't. Not in any way.
That's why we're able to talk about individuals in the way that we do, because they are specific.
Yes. And exceptional and always convicted.
Yeah, that's true.
They are not. These are not allegations.
No.
These have all been proven in court. And indeed, most of the cases that we talk about are well documented. I'm doing something later this week, in fact, for another company about a killer called Mark Martin, who killed in Nottingham.
Haven't we done him?
We have, yes.
Yeah.
I want to be Nottingham's first serial killer.
I remember.
Always known as Reds. These are unusual characters.
Did we do him?
I can't remember.
I can't remember. That's not good, my brain, honestly.
Yeah.
I can't remember. I know you've done him before.
I have.
Oh, we'll have to check.
We will.
Okay, well...
But let's do something cheerful now
thanks,
for a bit,
Dad.
Shall we?
So that's two parts of the railway killers.
It does deserve two parts, that, because it would be a very big, long...
Yeah, it's a lot of ground to cover. There are a few people that we have selected who do cross into two parts.
Yeah.
A few others that we will do down the line.
Yes.
Definitely.
But yes, let's talk about something...
Something cheerier.
Cheerier.
What was I saying before? We said we were going to talk about that book that
The Golden Gate Killer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mentioned a book in this podcast, which had been published, written by a woman who had, in fact, devoted her life pretty much to trying to unravel this particular killer in California, the so-called Golden Gate Killer. And she had done the most extraordinary forensic examination of it, published it, but hadn't quite finished when she died, quite unexpectedly, at the age of 47. The book was finished and is, in fact, number one bestseller in New York. And the person whom she identified has recently been arrested for the Golden Gate killings. And the man who was imprisoned for the killings has now, quite rightly, suing for his release and saying he was falsely imprisoned. It is, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name. But if you look up Golden Gate Killer, you'll find
him. Hold on, I'll have a look now. Did she have some kind of connection to the man who was imprisoned falsely?
No, she didn't. She was married to an actor. She's a writer. And it is the most astonishing success. Just proves that true crime books can sometimes...
Not the Golden State Killer.
Golden State Killer.
That's it.
Yeah.
I'll Be Gone in the Dark.
That's it. I'll Be Gone in the Dark.
One Woman's Obsessive Search for the Golden State Killer.
Golden State
Killer. By Michelle Eileen McNamara.
Yeah.
Published in February 2018. Yeah. There you go. So you can look it up. Looks good.
It is. I read it.
Well, you notified everyone it was good before, and then everyone caught up with you as usual.
It is a superb, quite marvellous, marvellous piece of work, and written with incredible erudition at the same time passion. She went to enormous, extraordinary lengths to pin down, you know, who'd been where, what she. I mean, she looked back at yearbooks, at who was in what class at what time, when they were, she went to the houses they were. I mean, obsession, an absolute complete obsession.
Nice.
And a wonderful one, but sadly she didn't live to see
the success.
But her husband is very moving, a last part of the book in which he describes how keen she was and how much all the family had wanted to see
how thrilled
her book
she would have been.
Mm. It's a very, very, very moving book.
That's good.
And certainly the best true crime book I've read in some considerable time.
And so, yeah, you mentioned before that you're going to, well, you will have been by now to go and see your posters and your...
Yes, I'm going to go and see my posters.
And your show will have, first F of your show will have been on.
Yes, it will.
Which is very exciting.
Yes.
Fingers crossed that everyone likes it and you'll get to do some more.
Yes, keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah. Definitely. That would be great.
It would be.
I will be in Tokyo. I'm not just going to Tokyo. I'm going to Tokyo for a week and then I'm going to some islands down in the south of Japan near Taiwan called the Okinawa Prefecture. And I'm staying...
Is that the South China Sea?
Yeah.
Where the Chinese are building those strange concrete harbours?
Don't know the answer to that question, Dad. I'm going for the beauty, so I'm going to say no.
Okay. I think it is where they're building them.
Hopefully I can't see them from my island.
No, I'm sure you won't be able to see them from your window.
But... Yeah, I'm going. I'm really excited about that. My big holiday for the year.
Very good, darling. I think it's a terrific idea. I'm not going on a big holiday.
You're too busy to go on holiday.
So it seems at the moment, anyway. Perhaps it'll all go quiet and I shall go on holiday. But I'm not very good at holidays. I quite like...
No, you've never been any good at holidays.
No, I don't. I'm not really my thing.
No.
I like the familiar.
As a child, Geoffrey was... I'm never good at holiday. I mean, he was very nice to go on holiday with. Don't get me wrong. But if you take him away from anywhere where he can access a newspaper or the radio or, I don't know, NBC, what's the American news channels or whatever, CNN or whatever, he'd basically melt.
Yes, I've never been keen on...
He'd get very edgy.
Yes, even in the Sahara, where I was in April, I do manage to get at least two English language news channels.
Yeah.
Which is no small feat.
I mean, now it's totally different, isn't it? Because you could just access the internet from anywhere. But back when I was a kid, that wasn't...
No, that wasn't...
He would literally drive... We'd stay somewhere and he'd drive, I don't know how far, just to get a newspaper in the morning.
Yeah.
Always.
Yes.
Even if it was like 3 days behind.
Oh, well, always. Yeah. I don't mind if they're 3 days old.
Yeah.
I quite like that. I get the... Sometimes manage to get... The New York Times used to be the International Herald Tribune, but now it's the International New York Times, or now it's just called the New York Times, International Edition.
What, when you're in the Sahara?
Yeah, you can sometimes find it, and there's some places you get it, particularly if you're near an airport, because they can fly it in.
That's true.
But
often a few days behind, I guess.
Yeah, it's usually at least two. Yeah, 2 days behind. But, you know, that's why I like Paris or the south of France. You can get... You know, British papers the same day.
Nowadays you can get them everywhere.
Yeah.
It's all a bit, it's pretty different.
But I'm very keen on you going to Japan because my West book was published in Japan and I always wanted to go.
I know.
I always wanted to go on a tour. I did a tour of Australia. But,
I remember. They wouldn't let you go to Japan.
They wouldn't let me go to Japan. And I was really enjoyed it. The Japanese have...
Japanese are really keen on true crime, so perhaps I'll be able to pick up some new listeners while I'm over there.
Please do. They love true crime.
Don't forget to like and subscribe to our podcast, everyone, and tell all your friends to do the same. That would be ideal. And a big thank you to our producer, Poppy Damon, and my brother, Dan Wansell, for doing the music, and my friend, George Lee, who drew our caricature.
And thank you all so much for listening. It's a great privilege to do it, and I couldn't be more grateful.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Dad.